think they're just checking there, Jermaine, you know, because they take so much more care these days over head injuries. I think the referee just wants to make sure from the Tottenham medical staff that he is actually okay to come back on, not just patched up again.
You know, I've never seen a referee actually stop the game for that, though. They usually allow the ball to go out of play and then make that decision, but it's actually good to see.
Yeah, I think that's superb referee.
Yeah, it's brilliant to see. You know, obviously that he's very conscious of the fact that there could have been a concussion.
Welcome to the Sound of Football podcast. I'm Graham Sidley, and as usual, I'm joined by Jan Bilton.
Hello.
And Terry DeFerland.
Hello.
Well, guys, it's been a bit of a low week, isn't it, this week? Because, you know, we're not in Germany anymore.
No.
Yeah, it wasn't as good as last week.
No. Last weekend was brilliant, wasn't it?
It was very good.
This time last week, we were on our way back, weren't we?
We were. We were sat in Dusseldorf Airport, playing Dead or Alive.
Yeah, yes. And we must never ever talk about that again.
Discuss that. Until we release the podcast this summer, 2020.
But what a cracking weekend though, Jan, wasn't it?
It was wonderful. Everything about it was wonderful. The football, obviously, which is what we're here to talk about, was amazing. The game at Dusseldorf was one of the finest games I've ever seen. It was brilliant. It was great to be part of it. And then there was that goal.
That was that goal.
The absolute goal.
Well, no, the absolute goal was
the. Oh, that was the one after.
That was the one afterwards.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that was the absolute goal.
Yeah.
The one before that was also an absolute goal.
It was an absolute goal.
Yeah.
It was.
Certainly was a goal.
Yeah. Commentary is hard. Everything that we'd hoped it would be the weekend, really, because we saw a great non-league game on Sunday as well.
We saw Tyrol Düsseldorf against Nettetal.
Of course, listeners will, if you heard last week's episode, you will have heard us going on about how lovely it was in Germany, but here's us going on about it a bit more this week. Yeah, I for one can't wait to get out there again, so roll on next year and we'll go out and see some more German football. Oh yeah, we've got to thank John as well for coming along and helping us out on the Sunday as well.
Great to see John. Always good to hear his voice on the podcast.
Yeah. Don't hear him so much on podcasts these days, do you?
No, well, because he doesn't work for the Bundesliga, but he works for the company that does the TV for the Bundesliga, so he tends to keep his opinions to himself. He also is a commentator as well, and so therefore I think prefers a certain neutrality and doesn't like to talk about his fandom of San Paoli and FC Cologne.
Oh,
you better cut that out, mate.
Oh, okay, I'll make sure I do that. But this week we are not going to be going on about what a great time we had on Germany, because we've already done that for a couple of
weeks. Done it.
Yeah, because we've just done it. But what we are going to do is talk about a story that cropped up just over the last few days, really. It's the thing that keeps on popping up, and that is head injuries, and specifically concussion, and the way that it fits within the game these days, and about the reaction amongst fans and the media to head injuries, what should be done, and about how the rules should be tightened up. We've got a lot to cover here, but we'll talk about the incidents first. Jan, the first incident we want to talk about is Jan Vertonghen's head injury in the Champions League semi-final.
Hmm.
Nasty clash with his own player, wasn't
Yes, it was, yeah. That caused him to go down, and he was bleeding quite heavily and received quite a lot of treatment and was clearly in a bad way, but deemed fit enough to continue. But that wasn't the case, because he started staggering around and he clearly didn't look in a good way. And I think he was retching, and it was awful to watch.
Yeah,
it really was. But as it turns out, it wasn't a concussion at all.
No. It has since come out that, and it looked at the time, it was a nose injury.
Yeah.
All right, it is a head injury, but it was basically he smashed his nose. It doesn't look great when you see someone stumbling around on a pitch with whose legs have obviously gone and looking for the world to be basically punched drunk.
Yeah.
And so it is natural for everyone to leap on the, so what the hell is this guy doing on the pitch? What have the Tottenham doctors done? Why is he still out there?
Mm.
And what was your immediate reaction when you...
Well, much the same as everybody else's. I mean, I assumed that it was a head injury.
Yeah.
And that I could only imagine that concussion protocol hadn't been overseen properly. I'd have a degree of sympathy for doctors in that situation anyway, because they're under a tremendous amount of pressure to get the player back on the pitch, in fairness, but also to make a decision in a very, very short space of time, seconds, and that isn't always easy to do. I don't think medicine is easy or as straightforward as that. And it turns out that actually they were right, while at the same time, perhaps, also being wrong. I mean, that he probably didn't have concussion. They said, well, he hasn't got concussion. And they said, how are you feeling? Yeah, okay, I'm fine, good to go. On he goes. Then maybe he's had some kind of secondary shock or trauma from the blow.
Yeah.
Or as I think you said beforehand, Jan, before we recorded, that perhaps he might have swallowed some blood or something like that.
Yeah.
And it's caused some nausea and some dizziness, and then that's happened. I don't know, then we're moving into medical stuff. But at the time, I was also thinking about the Lloris instance a few years back when he got a head injury and they were reluctant to take him off. And then you kind of were putting two and two together and thinking, well, is there a problem at Tottenham? Mm. But I mean, these are all wickedly hot takes in, you know, seconds, minutes after these things have happened.
Mm.
It's not really wise to form opinions that soon afterwards, especially now that we know what actually happened. But it's deeply worrying when you see stuff like that happening anyway. It always makes you tensed up a little bit because you just think, crikey.
Yeah. As I understand it, it takes in excess of 10 minutes to do a proper assessment to see if someone's been concussed. So you're right, the pressure on a doctor to make that decision in minutes.
He's got three minutes.
He's got 3 minutes.
Yeah, that's what the rules are at the moment.
Yeah.
The doctor can have 3 minutes on the pitch with the injured player
right.
to assess whether or not he is fit to continue.
Right. Yeah, and so if that is the case, that it takes considerably longer than 3 minutes to assess someone's ability to continue after a head injury, then you possibly need to look at changing either the number of minutes. Obviously, you can't stop the game for that long, but
yeah.
maybe having some kind of like a blood bin or something like that where you can, you know, go and be properly assessed.
And that's been one of the solutions put about, isn't it? Just getting a temporary substitution to take place so that you can take the injured player off the field, carry on with the game, and if he's passed fit to return, then he can swap back with the temporary replacement. Now, that sounds great in theory, but are we creating problems as well that it then becomes a tactical thing that clubs can and will exploit?
Well, I suppose it's possible, yeah, that they will use that for tactical advantage. And I mean, I think you pointed out before that we've seen it in rugby, haven't we?
Yeah.
Although it's probably worth bearing in mind that we hear about these instances in rugby rarely. And then when they do happen, they tend to make the news, which suggests that it's...
That was in the early days of their substitution rules, where you couldn't have a substitute for any other...
For any other reason. Now they've gone where you can now have tactical substitutions.
Yeah, because it was being abused. And so
I mean, that's a daft rule.
Yeah.
I mean, we already have the ability to have tactical and injury substitutions. I mean, I think the initial substitutions were always with the idea of an injury rather than tactics. But then, because it started that way, and because it was a fairly unwritten, it was not an unwritten situation, it was like, in the event of injury, you can have, you can have substitutions. And the idea was, the implicit idea was, to say, when a player gets injured, you know, you can have a substitution. But I don't think they were necessarily said they have to be for injuries.
Yeah.
You can just do it. If you want to, you can substitute a player. You can substitute two in a game. Or one in a game is probably what it started off at. And then, of course, managers went, well, actually, I can use this for tactical reasons as well. Mm. So I can have a couple of guys, good guys in. You know.
I can throw an extra defender on if I need to, attacker.
Which is great. Yeah. And a perfectly sensible, organic approach to doing that. But what it didn't do is it didn't fundamentally address the initial issue of it, which is like when your player is injured, you can substitute him off. And now we're at a point where managers are looking at certain players, particularly valuable players, and thinking, well, I can't, if I substitute him, then that gives me a tactical disadvantage, so I've got a problem here. And so then if you then go, right, well, let's bring in injury subs, proper injury subs or technical subs, whatever you want to call them, then the worry is that coaches will go, well, hang on, here's an opportunity for me. I suspect that if these guys are the professionals that they're supposed to be, that they wouldn't abuse that system because it is there for their benefit. But on the other hand, when the chips are really down towards the end of the season, you know, relegation, promotion, championships, playoff places are on the line, and you're looking for any kind of edge, then there's a possibility that may well be abused that you'll get. But you're asking a player to fake injury and you're asking the medical staff to back up that fake injury.
Yeah.
And then you're asking the coach to lie. Everybody there, so you've got three different parties, possibly about four or five different people, all participating in a conspiracy.
I was going to say, that's quite a conspiracy.
That doesn't sound terribly realistic to me.
Yeah. But we've already established that it's very difficult to diagnose concussion.
Yeah.
So anyone can say, oh, I bit my head. And especially when a lot of these incidents happened with players from the same side, like the Tongan case.
But if a doctor deliberately lies and says this person has concussion, for example, or an injury for which they can no longer continue, and then it can be proved absolutely that in fact that was not the case, then the doctor concerned, their reputation is on the line.
Yeah, you've got to conclusively prove it. And you have who's going to do that?
But I mean, what you would have, I suppose, is in the Premier League, you could probably afford to have independent.
Yeah.
But my suggestion would be is that these should probably be handled by independent doctors anyway.
Yeah.
I think there should be a panel of doctors specialising in that area who, like referees, are allocated matches. And then they decide whether a player, and then that way the decision is out of the hands of the coaches and staff, of the medical staff of the clubs.
Well, that sounds all very, very sensible, especially if you have an independent doctor at every game who can go onto the pitch and say, right, you're going off, rather than a club doctor.
Yeah.
That sounds like something that should be in place anyway. But you're only going to get that at the top level.
Yeah, you won't be able to get it. You might be able to get it at maybe as low as League One or Two, perhaps.
Yeah.
But what you would need is you'd need some extra money from probably the Premier League to play that. What you wouldn't get is you wouldn't get that, obviously, at, let's say, at non-league level, where Whiteleaf play, for example.
Yeah.
But I doubt they've got doctors sitting on the bench with them anyway.
No, and there's a strong argument to say that you can't have, you know, there's hundreds of these games being played every Saturday.
Yeah.
Throughout the course, you can't have all these doctors just sat there on the off chance.
Some guys going,
that's just crazy. Yeah, I mean, so we are only talking about top level. And the thing is, I think the real worry about the game is at the grassroots level, where it's not regulated, where there isn't the resources, where they don't have the professional medical staff on hand to be able to make these kind of judgments, and where, you know, it's entirely likely that undiagnosed concussion takes place and has had a detrimental, injurious effect in the long term on players, and they never really knew it.
Yeah.
Or perhaps they've always suspected, or it was that game against.
Yeah.
It was a game against, you know, old Rutledge in thirds, you know, back in 1997. I cracked my head against it. I've never been the same since. I've never got it checked. But, I reckon there are stories like that knocking about all over the country.
Yeah.
This is the inherent danger of playing football.
Well, yeah, there is. And you accept that when you step onto the pitch, don't you? You should do as much as you possibly can to try and protect the player and make it safe for them. So at non-league level, yeah, it's not practical to do that. So it's not much changes. But you can do it in the professional game. And I think that the risk of any shenanigans or any bending of the rules, if there was, for example, a kind of a 10-minute temporary substitution, I think that is balanced quite nicely by the fact that, you know, you can, as a player, you can step onto the pitch knowing that if I get hurt, I'm protected, I'm safe, I'm going to go to a safe place and I'll be watched by a medical professional, whether that's independent or not. So I think the protection of the player should be paramount. And if people are abusing it, I don't think that's a reason to stop, or the potential of people abusing it, I don't think that's a reason to stop it being brought in.
No, sure. Now, the second incident was Mo Salah. Now, that was a concussion. It has been proved today that he was concussed, and as a result will miss the second leg of their game against Barcelona, which some may say, well, that game's pretty much over anyway. Now, all the protocols have been followed here. The doctor came on, said he was concussed, and he obviously was, because he got quite a big whack to the head. And everything seems to have gone correct. So we've got two incidents where everything has been done to the standards that have been set.
Yeah.
And the correct guidelines have been followed. The actual concussed player has been taken off, and the non-concussed player was allowed to stay on. And although, yes, it was, he soon came off because obviously he went into shock. Is there an argument to say, well, actually, the rules are okay as they are? Look, we've seen two incidents here, and they were handled properly. Is there or not?
Well, possibly. But the difference with the Mo Salah incident was that he went straight down.
Yeah.
And he was not getting back up.
Yeah.
I mean, he made no attempt to stand up again. I was watching it at home. My wife was walking past at the time, and she went, he does not look in a good way, because he was just not moving. That's what makes it very, very different to the Vertonghen incident. And as well as that, Vertonghen was diagnosed as clear by the doctor, and he was correct.
Yeah.
Whereas Salah was clearly concussed, and that's why he's missing out on the Barca game, which he's probably quite pleased about, I would imagine, because it's not going to be much fun.
But still fit enough to play supposedly, so Klopp says, as you were saying, that he's going to be fit for next Sunday's game, for the season finale.
Well, 7 days has passed by then, so you'd assume by then that, you know, if anything's going to show up, it would have done by then. So, his season's not over.
Yeah. Unless something does show up in the intervening time, which case then things could get tricky. What would be interesting to learn is if the doctor said, look, there's a small percent chance that he's not clear yet, and I would recommend for the long-term health of him that he not play.
Yeah.
But whose decision is that? Is that the coach's decision? Is it the player's decision, or is it the doctor's decision?
Yeah.
So that it will be interesting to see where the guidelines go in there. Probably written down somewhere. I don't know. Maybe it's not. I wouldn't mind betting that it's probably ultimately the coach's final decision, but that the coach probably has to take responsibility for the consequences of that. But I think where it gets sticky is where players get up. They've been concussed, but they still sort of get up. I'll never forget that guy, that Uruguay player in the World Cup in 2014, I think it was. And the doctors, he'd had a head injury, and the doctors were saying, right, you know, he's coming off. And the guy looked at him and went, no. It was a World Cup game, and he was really on it. And he was like, I am definitely not going off. You know, and he starts effing and jeffing as well. And the doctors are going, oh, dude, all right, dude, don't hit me. You know, and in the end, you know, they sent him back on. But I just thought, you know, that can't happen. You can't have that decision made by the player, because the player's just had his head literally... had a head injury, and the doctors are saying that he's not fit to carry on. I mean, you have to be able to enforce that properly, and if necessary. I mean, because that was interesting, because with the Vertonghen thing, the referee came over when Vertonghen was about to come onto the pitch, wasn't he? And he said, look, what's going on here? In a kind of, you know, implied that that's what he was saying, you know, obviously in Swedish. But I mean, he was saying, you know, he was clearly expressing concern about whether or not this was being done properly, you know. I mean, and I think that that's good refereeing for a referee to say, look, I'm responsible for what goes on here. Are you certain that this guy is fit enough to come onto the pitch? Because he looks pretty messed up. And they did. But, I mean, I don't think a referee can do more than that. But I think it gets tricky where the players are up and about and are saying that they're okay and they want to carry on. Yeah. And most of them will want to carry on. They're very competitive. Yeah. They're not going to want to get hooked, you know, for any reason.
Which is why I think that it probably is a good idea that you give them 5 or 10 minutes out, because then you're only missing a small amount of the game. All right, it might be a crucial part of it, but your health's at stake here, so we want to make sure that you're okay.
Yeah.
So sitting out just to...
Blood bins are a great idea.
Yeah.
I think blood bins are particularly... I mean, you have them in rugby league, don't they? And it's a very physical game, incredibly high contact, very needs to have stuff like that. Yeah. But rolling substitutions, I think, at professional level, we have such big squads now that we can manage them. Not rolling substitutes, but you know what I mean. I mean, maybe, you know, certainly injuries. Just like bring a guy on and then say, you can, if you're okay, then you come back. And then you've got, take pressures off, get them back into the dressing room, sitting down, do a thorough examination, and then go to the coach, right, coach, he's good to get back on.
Yeah.
But give the coach the freedom to say, all right, cool, but actually, do you know what? I'm just going to keep things as they are now.
Well, how would that have been last year, in last year's Champions League final? Lawrence Karius gets a whack to the head.
Yes.
And carries on.
Yeah.
And it only comes out that he's concussed a few days later.
Yeah, by which point the damage is done. Yeah.
If you've got, say, unlimited goalkeeper subs.
Yeah.
At least for that position.
Yeah, yeah.
Because there's no tactical advantage, really, from changing a goalkeeper.
No, it's a disadvantage in theory.
Yeah.
Because, you know, swapping out goalkeepers is just not something that's done.
Yeah.
Very rarely. You know.
But if you've got the case where, especially because as goalkeepers are, whenever there's an injury to a goalkeeper, the game stops. You can't just leave the pitch and allow the game to go on. So maybe having unlimited goalkeeper substitutions where you can swap your goalkeeper as many times as you like, or back and forth.
Yeah.
How would that have changed? Sensible. How would that have changed the outcome of the Champions League?
I mean, Liverpool might have won that game.
Yeah, they might well have done.
Because... Yeah. The Lawrence Karius wouldn't have made that initial mistake.
Yeah. Or he could have been off for at least 5 minutes, and then they could have had a thorough examination of him and decided whether or not he could have played on. And Liverpool wouldn't have lost a substitution. They wouldn't have had a disadvantage of having an injured player, and everything would have been okay.
The scenarios where Karius had the ball, where he made those mistakes with the distribution of the ball.
Yeah.
So it just simply wouldn't have happened with another goalkeeper.
Yeah.
Not because that goalkeeper is better or worse than Karius, it's just because they're different human being. Yeah. They would have made a different tactical choice there.
The instant he made a first error.
Yeah.
Then the coach could have said, right, okay,
I'm hooking him. Yeah.
I'm hooking him now because...
I'm making a mistake. Because what I'm saying is this guy's injured.
Yeah.
And he's obviously made a really
bad
mistake.
And if you've got the option of being able to put him back on, then I think you've got...
Yeah.
It hasn't got that sort of... You've not got that, like the situation with that Uruguayan fella where he just loses it on there. In many respects, though, how many players do you see going down with the merest touch holding their heads?
Yeah.
Because they know that if the referee thinks that a stray elbow was deliberate, then the opposition could get down to 10 men. You do see that the players can make the most of contact to the head.
Mm. They can. I just think that it's just not worth the risk.
Yeah.
If there's going to be shenanigans, then you deal with shenanigans. But I think when it comes to someone's health and when they're playing a game, clearly it's not as challenging a game physically as rugby league. It's not as dangerous.
Certainly.
But it's incredibly quick. And it's physical and it can be quite brutal. And if you get a knock to your arm or your leg or your chest or whatever, bones can be reset. But if you damage your brain, that's clearly not a good thing. And if it's made worse by the fact that someone's made a wrong decision or they've had pressure put on them or they've felt under pressure to tell someone to go back onto the pitch, I just think that it's worth any kind of risk that you might get.
Okay, so we agreed that we should do something. This isn't just a set of rules that has to be put on so that football is seen to be doing the right thing. It's actually doing the right thing.
Mm.
But is there anything we can do to the actual game? Because all of these are reactive processes. What about something proactive? How can we stop head injuries from happening? Should that be the focus rather than how we deal with them once they've already happened?
The only way to do that is to take the aerial element out of the game.
Yeah.
Then the Vertonghen incident doesn't happen. In fact, both the incidents that we're talking about wouldn't have really happened. But then you can have to ban headers, and I just think that's wrong.
Yeah.
I think the reality is when you said does it need to change? Do the rules need to change? Because it looks like they're working fine on both those instances.
Yeah.
I think that it shines a light on something that's obviously very, very important, and I think that yes, we should do something about it. But the amount of times that it's going to actually happen. I mean, how many times do you get a player with a concussion?
Yeah.
I mean, it's quite rare. It does happen, but the argument for banning headers is more to do with the repetitive blows to the head
long term, which is
that's a powerful reason.
Perhaps even more important than isolated incidents, single isolated incidents.
Did you see the documentary that Alan Shearer did on this subject?
Yeah,
and it was more about the repeated heading of the ball. The view from the doctors he was talking to was the actual playing of the game.
Yeah,
and heading the ball during the game, you're probably only going to head the ball half a dozen times, maybe a dozen times, whatever. If you're a defender, maybe that's not the issue. It's the training. It's the problem where you're doing it hundreds and hundreds of times a day. It's up to you how often you head the ball in training, or it's up to the coach to decide how often that happens. But this is about collisions. The only way to do that, as I said, is to remove the aerial aspect of it. But I think that it's so rare that I don't think that's worth doing. And it would fundamentally change the game, wouldn't it? It becomes a different game.
It would. But all the time you have that, you're right, you do have to practice headers. You do have to... You do have to practice going in for an aerial challenge. Mm. You do have to know how to score.
Mm.
Like if you're someone like Alan Shearer and you get a large percentage of your goals throughout your career from your head, he only got that because he practiced constantly heading the ball, and it paid off for him. And so players are always looking for that edge. And they if you tell them, all right, you're only allowed to practice headers for 10 minutes a day. That's all you're allowed. Even then, you're going to get a load of headers in there, aren't you? But they're not going to stick to that because no one's going to be watching. There's no.
Well, you'd have to have people constantly monitoring.
Yeah. There's not going to be invigilators there.
It's not Formula One where it's like massively expensive to do any kind of practice, so therefore it's easy to monitor how much practice is done and limit it. These guys can just find a field somewhere and just practice their heading.
And as well as that, it's there's a risk of it causing damage. That it's not guaranteed it's going to cause damage. It's not like smoking. You know what I mean? it's going to really...
Well, we don't know. That's the worst thing. Is there is emerging studies coming through now, but this is really only just coming to fore in the last 10 years or so.
Mm.
10 years' time, we may know a hell of a lot more as brain scans become a lot more sophisticated, as our understanding of how these injuries occur. Mm. And, it may not be the problem that it was for a lot of players in the 60s. The occurrence of early onset dementia amongst players
from sort of our parents' generation is huge. You look at the at that England World Cup winning team and the number of players that, that have mental health issues, early onset mental health issues, is beyond coincidence. And of course, you know, Jeff Astle's case is very, very, very prominent, and it and it is certainly something that is worth further investigation.
Yeah.
Of course, in those days, they were playing with heavier balls, much heavier balls.
That, that got heavier across the game as well.
Got heavier with the ball, as because they were playing on muddy pitches and the pitches and the balls got wet, and they got they're completely different nowadays. So hopefully, that risk is lessened. But of course, you know, they were practicing with the, these heavy balls as a kid, so a lot of that damage was done even before they became professionals.
Ultimately, if it does prove that repetitive heading, even with very, very light balls, causes brain some kind of or can cause brain damage, then a lot of people will choose to no longer play this sport, and that's pretty much it. And that will eventually filter its way all up to the professional level where you've got a fewer players to choose from, and that, that will have an effect. And I think when we talked about this in our, in a podcast maybe a year or so ago, we speculated as the possibility that a second game might emerge in which there, everything is played on the deck. So like futsal, only outdoors. And that we may see the development of that game, and which may prove to be popular even as a spectator sport. So these are things that we may see, and this is the natural organic development of sport and culture and civilization. I mean, that, and it's nothing to be frightened of. It's just sort of like people sort of saying, you know what, I don't think I want my kids playing that sport. I think I would rather they play this sport. Because ultimately, for the overwhelming majority of people who play football, they do it for health and leisure reasons. And for fitness reasons, and began for fun, and because it's fun. They don't do it for money. They don't do it necessarily for the glory. They don't even necessarily do it for the competitive spirit. They do it because it's a fun thing to do with your mates. And so if they say, well, actually, you know, well, there's a pretty good chance you could develop a head injury if you play 10, 15 years at Sunday league, you know, heading the ball, and they might, well, I'll just go and do something else instead. And that's what they'll do. I mean, and that's fine. I think that's perfectly fine. People have the right to make informed choices. And I think that that's what this should all have to be about.
Yeah, is you've informed choices. To smoking. And lots of people smoke, even though they're aware of the health issues. And I would I could see a situation where people say, well, you know, I feel okay when I hit a ball. It doesn't. I don't feel dizzy or woozy or anything.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing that would change would be legalities. I mean, like, you know, you know, compliance team getting in there. Fine, you're 14, you want to sign professional papers in, or you're 18, sorry, you want to sign professional papers. I say, yeah, that's fine. You've got to sign a waiver though that you won't sue us if you get brain damage.
This is you know, the main thing, isn't it? It is the fear of litigation that is probably carrying the real driving force behind this, isn't it? It's because they don't want players.
You have to accept the risk of doing this work if you want to do it, and it's hazardous. And if you accept the risk of it, then the rewards are tremendously high. And that's fine. And you and again, I don't want to sound like a Tory, but I mean, I don't have a problem with that. But the main thing is that do people, the problem with smoking was that for years, no people lied about it, the effects of smoking that it had on your body. And to the extent to which it was a killer, and to the extent to which it was addictive, and it was difficult to give up. And I mean, what you're looking for is if there is a truth about heading the ball, then the truth be told. And we have to be careful because we live in an age of people not vaccinating their children because of made up stories about the vaccine. So we have to be very careful. We live in an age of alternative facts and fake news and post-truth malarkey. So it's difficult for the truth to come through, but it is important that that be the case. But it's all part of the rich tapestry, isn't it?
I have said on our Twitter account, and we have talked about it before on this podcast, about the idea of football without headers, with a non-aerial game of football. But is there a halfway ground? Is there somewhere that isn't as severe as no headers? Can we think of a game? Headgear?
I wouldn't be at all surprised
if
there were some manufacturers working on headgear specifically for football, for soccer, so that you can wear a thin but tough headpiece that molds around the head and still allows you to be able to control the ball with your head, but softens the impact.
And probably technologically advanced to actually measure readings of impacts.
That wouldn't surprise me at all. I would think that that would be in development. I would think that it would be something that far-sighted sports kit manufacturers should be thinking about. There must, because they should be looking at the industry or the industry news and seeing what's happening and what's changing, hearing about these soccer schools in the US that are like a little bit concerned about using getting sued, and thinking, there's a market here. We could be looking at a market where, you know, maybe not at the professional level, but at schoolboy level, schoolgirl level, and at grassroots level, that if we could produce something that's affordable, that they could slap those things on them and wear those. And I wouldn't even be at all surprised if our good friend, Bald FIFA Guy, was, you know, encouraging these manufacturers to get involved in that himself. And no doubt for a modest consultancy fee to help them through those tricky compliance issues.
Petr Cech, obviously, he had a terrible head injury, and he wore the kind of rugby style protection, which probably
scrum hat.
Yeah,
which affects us, isn't it?
Yeah, but when I've played rugby myself, I've never bothered with that because I'm not in the scrum because I'm not stupid. The point is that it's really only there to protect you from superficial injuries, like, you know, getting your ear
soft
ripped
tissue.
Off. That's all it's there for. So him wearing that, if it makes him feel a little bit safer, then that's great. But I think what Terry's talking about is something completely different, radically different, which I think is a really good point. I think that would be potentially the way to go.
It might not be possible to a piece of equipment.
It does make you think, well, how would you get the control there? But people wear boots on their feet, so
it's basically
a boot for your head.
I'm pretty certain that the people are clever enough to figure out how to use it. It would require an adjustment, and you would, like, if you were to hand them out to professional players now and say, right, you're going to wear this from now on, and they'd be like, I don't think so. For all kinds of reasons.
It's another sponsorship place.
But it is another sponsorship place.
And it could look pretty cool.
It could look daft. But I mean, the point is, if they're safe. I mean, obviously, amateur boxers, as we know, wear headgear. And so that would be this. But I'm sure that you could do it when it would only have to be skeletal. And I would invest in such a caper if I had any money.
Yeah.
Another thing, though, as well, is there are conflicting studies that say that protective gear in boxing is the root cause of a lot of the problems of head injuries there.
Right.
Yeah. That, like the skull cap, the head protectors that they wear in the amateur boxing just protect against soft tissue damage.
Yeah.
And the fact that even the gloves, that the introduction of gloves has now caused more head injuries, because in the old days of bare knuckle fights, when you hear the story of fights going on for hundreds of rounds, it's because they never punched each other in the face.
Mm. Yeah, because you're going to damage your hand.
You're going to damage your hand. Yeah. All they did was punch, was body blows the time, because it's the bodies are a lot softer.
Yeah, I mean, you don't see much. You don't see much of that in MMA. The gloves that they wear are hardly anything.
It's just to protect their skin, isn't it?
Yeah. So you don't get that much because they've got more options, in fairness. But you do see it, but you don't see it necessarily as much because of the sports discipline. Mm. Yeah, I mean, doctors, you can never get a consensus out of doctors. But, you know, I mean, if it can be demonstrated by peer review that a piece of equipment will mitigate the effects of head injuries or brain damage, then it behooves everyone involved to start thinking about developing and implementing it.
Yeah.
But that's the big if, I suppose, isn't it?
Mm.
It just needs to be some kind of shell that will just spread the force of the impact around itself and disappear. I mean, even wearing a gum shield, actually, when you're playing rugby, is not just there to protect you from dental injuries, but it also has a protective effect on head injuries as well. Because if you're hit around the jaw area,
it doesn't make your head go bang.
Yeah, it pushes
the old uppercut.
It pushes the energy out around it rather than going up through your head. I mean, it's not foolproof, obviously, but in that instance, it's protective against that. So I think that, you know, if you can do that and you can't communicate when you've got one in your mouth at all, it's ridiculous.
See, that's just sent me off on a whole new train of thought. I mean, why don't footballers wear gum shields then?
Well, you could wear gum shields.
It would also shut them. Do they? There's presumably no reason why they can't. They're allowed to if they want to.
Yeah.
Interesting.
But I think, as Jan said, it's not easy to communicate.
This is not necessarily a bad thing, though, is it?
It's easier with rugby because it stops a lot more.
Yeah.
So you can just take it out and say something and then put it back in again.
Yeah.
Whereas football, it's constantly going, isn't it? So, you know, that probably wouldn't be very practical if you were going to take it out.
True.
But, you know, if you're a defender and you're going to get an elbow in the face in a corner, or you're going to head the back of somebody else's head or whatever, you know, it might just help. I don't know. But certainly I like the idea of some kind of protective kind of crown, if you like.
Well, listeners, if you follow a sport that has its own issues with head injuries and you think you've got something to enlighten us with, because obviously we're reaching around here, we've spoken for the last half an hour about it, but we've come up with more questions than answers, I think, haven't we? And I think that seems to be what happens when most people start talking about this subject. But if you've got something to add to it, then please do get in touch through social media or our contact form on the website.
AFL, I think maybe the AFL players might wear some.
Yeah.
Headgear as well.
Yes.
I may be completely... So any Australian listeners who follow the AFL, maybe get in touch and give us your experience of that.
Yeah.
If you've played it.
A lot of these sports, obviously, they are very, very physical sports. But I think a footballer has got this uniqueness where you can use your head to play. And that means that there is a chance of deliberately heading a ball, and of course there is the possibility of two players going up for the same ball and stars and floating birds occurring afterwards. So yeah, please do, if you follow a sport that we haven't mentioned today, then please do get in touch with us about that. This weekend it's going to be our last weekend box set of the season, because the games are thinning out and pretty much they're all big games from now on. This weekend, we're going to be concentrating on the playoff semi-finals, because there are some great ones there. Sunderland play Portsmouth again.
I know.
Again.
I did have hopes of us meeting them back at Wembley.
Yeah.
But that's not to be. Yeah, we're playing them on Saturday night. So, that's going to ruin my weekend.
And once you pass them, who do you want in the... Who would you prefer in the final?
I don't know. I just don't want to be doing it. It's awful. He's awful. I don't know. I don't think we'll go up. Regardless, I think we're just not hitting the. We're not in a good run of form.
I think that's the issue, isn't it? Yeah.
So we're going under this, dropping out of form. The teams are going into it hitting form.
Yeah.
That's just not a good place to be.
Sunderland and Leeds staying down, I think, this year, sadly.
It looks like it. I can't see how Leeds are going to turn it around.
They've really ballsed it up. As people said they would. Yes. People said that Beelzebul would not last 46 games.
Yeah.
And it's proved to be so.
And it's certainly not going to last 49 games. No. But if you want to see what we pick for our last weekend box set of the season, and it will be back in August, don't worry about that, then get along to sofpodcast.com and click on the link for the weekend box set and subscribe. It's free. But that's all we have time for this week. We will be back next week. We've still got a couple more before our season ends. We won't have Terry though. You're on holiday next week. Yeah. So we're hopefully going to get a guest in next week. Mm-hmm. But for now, as I say, from me, Graham Sibley, from Jan Bilton, and from Terry Lidfellman, it's goodbye.
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 You can contact us through our website, sofpodcast.com, via Twitter, @soundoffootball, or on facebook.com/soundoffootball.
Oh, you got that one, don't you? He called me Colin. Can I say Colin here? You don't know why.